You've got TV shows you need reviewed. You've got movies you need to know what they're about. Who are you going to call? Screen Watching.
This is not like TV, only better.
Television! Teacher! Mother!
Secret lover.
What? That's it? That's your movie?
Well, I said that I had an idea for a movie.
Folks, this is Screen Watching. It's our weekly deep dive, a dalliance, I guess, into the world of what we've watched on our screens. My name is Dan Barrett, joined by Simon Foster. Simon Foster, we have so many movies, so many TV shows to get through this week. It's too many, and it's going to lead to the condition which has plagued this podcast almost never. It's too much show.
Yeah, it's a lot of show this week. Hello, Dan Barrett. Hello, all the screen watchers out there. We have so many things to talk about this week. We decided to add even a little bit more into the intermission section just to really pad this podcast out. But in the spirit of it being the latest Ghostbusters film in cinema, I'm wearing the badges. I'm wearing the badges you can see. You can see, what is that one? That's the Stay Puft. That's Ecto-1. That's Slimer there. If you just listen to this, you really should be on our video feed. But I'm kind of excited about Ghostbusters, but then having seen it, I got something to say. So there's plenty to talk about. I'm also checking out the new Sydney Sweeney thing called Immaculate.
You don't really need to sell the movie that way. You just say, I'm checking out the new Sydney Sweeney thing. Oh. And everyone else is like that. Suddenly taking a puff of their cigar going, yeah.
Yeah.
Simon Foster, we've rabbited on enough. And before I find myself having to utter the phrase, as we enter hour 7 of the podcast, let's try to prevent that from happening. And instead, let's just dive right now into the reviews.
It stinks.
All right, Simon, where are we going to take this from? Should we start with Sydney Sweeney? That's where I like to start my day.
Yes, I know. How could you not start with Sydney Sweeney? She's the it girl of the moment. She is coming off the, some might say, surprise. I'm happy for it to be a hit film, Anyone But You. And her new film is something completely different, as they say in Monty Python land. This is a film called Immaculate.
I know God saved me for a reason, but I guess I'm still searching for what that reason is.
Too much blood of Christ.
It's a miracle. You are with child.
Simon, I think there's something that's really fantastic about the fact that we live in a world that's really divided right now. Like, you know, politically, people aren't necessarily seeing eye to eye in a way they once did and were less forgiving of other people's viewpoints. So culturally, there's that happening. Because we now live in this digital world, like people aren't really watching the same TV shows at the same time. We don't have the same reference points for songs and sometimes movies. And like, we just live in a really fractured world. But I think there's just something so lovely about the fact that every single man and woman on this planet right now are more than happy to come together about their admiration for Sydney Sweeney.
You couldn't be more correct, Dan Barrett. It is she is the most adored person in the world at the moment. She is the it girl, as they used to say back in the 40s and 50s when I was a teenager. And it's a time when all of us can look to the future and hope that Sydney Sweeney brings back the movie star, that we haven't got a real movie star culture anymore. Tom Cruise is sort of hanging on with his front teeth trying to stick with that movie star thing, but in every other respect, it's not there. But Sydney Sweeney may be back. The fact she can go on SNL and have a bit of a joke fest about Madame Web and the role she played in it and how she wasn't really, you know, I thought that was very sweet and very funny. She's a very talented lady. Some might say that Immaculate is a bit of a left turn, a bit of an odd choice for an actress at this point in her career, because it is definitely not the crowd pleaser that some might expect her to go down. She plays a novice nun called Sister Cecilia. She's an American nun who decides to head off to a convent deep in the Italian countryside where she is going to take her vows of celibacy and poverty and all the vows that nuns take when they decide to live the convent lifestyle. And she meets all the young, equally pretty nuns around her, and she seems to get on with everyone. But there's a very young, very dashing priest at the center of the nun's existence who, and she strikes up kind of a chemistry a trustful relationship, but one that feels a little bit odd from the get-go. Soon, as the title would suggest, young sister Cecilia finds herself conceived. She becomes of child. It is the immaculate of the title. She goes to the convent a virgin. That is spoken of in very graphic terms when it's discovered she's pregnant. And she becomes the center of a great deal of adoration and fondness amongst all the nuns there as the pregnancy progresses. Now, this is a horror film, and for me, pregnancy-based horror films are kind of icky and sort of low-hanging fruit. It's not really hard to gross an audience out when you start talking about the reproductive organs and babies and all that sort of stuff. But what Immaculate does is take a really sort of B-movie concept and gives it a whole lot of meat on the bones. It gives it a whole lot of things that we can discuss. I'm going to go to a place here that the film struck me as being relevant to, so I hope I don't offend anyone. But this is really the first post Roe versus Wade horror film that we've seen and that confronts the argument over or the abortion debate, certainly in the US, and how it impacts the mother specifically in regard to this. And I'm sort of talking around this because I don't want to be too spoilerish, but this one is very much a pro-choice movie, and there's been quite a bit of internet talk about the connotations and the arguments that can be made coming out of this film. It's undeniably a pro-choice movie because of the final few moments in this movie, which are graphic and horrible and speak to the absolute nth degree a woman should have the right to choose within the sort of context of this horror setup. So I'm sort of skating around, and I hope people can understand I don't want to spoil the surprise or spoil the ending of the film. Suffice to say that there's a lot more here. Like all the great horror films, this is a film that you can look at the issues of the day, what's impacting society, how it transforms to the horror film setup and the horror film genre, and how well the filmmaker and the actress sort of adhere to those. Their aims and their goals with this film. It's a smart movie. It's a terrifying movie. It's a very icky movie in parts. It avoids the jump scares in favor of a real sense of menace. It's a fairly mature film, which I was pleasantly surprised to find out. Be warned, it's not going to be for everyone, which is why I think it's an odd choice for Sweeney at this point in time. Although having said that, stars have sort of made their way through life by doing the big crowd-pleasing blockbuster then going off and doing something a bit smaller, a bit darker, a bit more personal. And I guess that's what she's doing with this film. Immaculate is in most cinemas as we speak. They've given it a fairly wide release here based on her name. But be warned, it's not going to be for everybody.
Yeah, I'm going to try to make an effort to see this one later today, but we'll see how my day shapes up. But I don't know, I've heard mostly positive things about this one, so...
Definitely.
Should be good.
Definitely.
Yeah, and you're certainly not the first person to make that comparison, so Roe versus Wade.
Mm.
And even referred to as the first post-Roe versus Wade film as well. Simon, let's move on. Let's talk about the brand new Netflix smash hit, or maybe it will be. I guess we'll find out. It's called Three Body Problem.
I have to tell you something. Something insane. But true. About all of us. It started a long time ago.
Back in 1977, they detected a sequence. Called it the Wow Signal.
Now, Simon, this is a show where anticipation, certainly the expectation behind it, is incredibly high. So this is the first TV series to come by way of the creators of David Benioff and D.B. Weiss since they finished up a little show called Game of Thrones.
Yeah.
Now, obviously, the first show that we're going to do after Game of Thrones is going to be a lot of attention on it, and that's absolutely the case here. And Netflix have compounded the interest somewhat by taking one of the big sort of smash hits books from China, of all places. Not that it's like weird that this is a Chinese book, but it's weird that Benioff and Weiss are doing a book based on a Chinese property rather than something American. It's just kind of a bit odd. You just wouldn't expect that straight off the back of Game of Thrones. But this is what they've done. This is a show which there was actually a TV adaptation of it out of China last year, which you can find floating around on YouTube. I didn't watch that one. I saw some scattered moments here and there from it. It seemed interesting enough, but I was kind of hanging out to see this Netflix adaptation. So look, I sat down and I don't really know exactly what I watched with this first episode. My plan was to watch the first couple of episodes so I could get my head around it a bit more. Life got in the way, though, and when I say life got in the way, I mean there was a lot of vomit involved, and that's probably all we really need to share now. We don't need to go further in depth. So I've only seen the first episode, and it's kind of hard to tell people what the show is based off that first episode, because it sets up a lot of elements, and it is deliberately being obtuse and a little bit confusing in parts. Okay, but what I can probably say with a reasonable amount of certainty is that there is some sort of alien invasion or contact of some form that's taking place. There is some cross-time temporal elements to this program where you will see characters in younger and older forms. You will see a group of, I want to say it was 6 or 7 young scientists who all worked together on a project back in the day. Some of them maintained working on that project while others went off and sought wealth in other avenues. So these are all, like, your main cast here are all sort of early to mid-30 types. You've got one of the main characters in it who is an impossibly hot scientist, the likes of whom we've never seen with this level of hotness on screen since, what's her name? Dr. Bambi from The X-Files back in the day.
Yes, you're referring to Isa Gonzalez, who is one of the most striking young ladies in front of a camera at the moment. That's very true.
Yeah. Yeah, and so, look, it's so part of the plot involving her is that she is seeing some floating energy waveforms, I guess is probably the way to describe them. But as she starts concentrating and locking into it as you watch this first episode go on, it stops being just a series of just squiggly lines all over the place, and it starts taking the form of a time code that is ticking down. So the understanding that we have, because we've seen time codes before, is that it's, I'm trying to remember what the first number we see is, it was like 2 days and 14 hours or something. So we know that whatever's going to happen happens pretty soon. She's visited by a young woman who seems to be part of this alien force, or maybe is a visitor from the future. Who really knows? I'm sure that people have seen more than one episode do, which isn't me. But anyway, she ends up meeting her one night and she's like, hey, look, some stuff's going down. I know you don't believe me, but look up into the sky at midnight tomorrow night. You're going to see the sky winking at you. And immediately I thought about the sky winking at you, and I got concerned because the last time I heard a similar phrase like that was hearing about a horse winking. And that is an entirely different thing than what you're going to see here in Three Body Problem. I'm not going to reveal what the sky winking looks like, but it's pretty spectacular, and it's not that exciting on screen. But if you think about what it'd be like in real life to witness that, it'd be like, you know, this is really, you know, awe-inspiring and deeply scary at the same time.
Let me jump in just quickly. During my trip to China last year for the Worldcon Science Fiction Convention, I was fortunate enough to not meet but be present when the author of the book, Li Zhijing, I think it's how it's pronounced, forgive me if I get that wrong, did a bit of a welcome and a bit of a chat about what he expected from the Netflix adaptation of his best-selling, an international bestseller. It's been translated into 28 languages and has gone around the world. So it's a true sort of landmark science fiction book. I've watched the first two episodes of this series. It certainly has been streamlined from a lot of the very heavy scientific text that was in the book is gone, certainly in those first two episodes. I'm kind of grateful that the Game of Thrones team didn't fully jettison the role of the Chinese Cultural Revolution and Chinese history played in the formation of the book and the plot of the book. The Netflix series certainly ups the cool young kid sort of modern talk kind of element that wasn't in the book to any great extent. This is clearly made for more than just the Chinese audience, and that's not surprising. Netflix want a global audience for this, and so they've given us the most palatable version of it. But from what I've seen from the first two episodes, the Game of Thrones team find a good balance between adapting the smarts of the original text and the density of the original text with a more palatable sort of home viewing, couch time, binging experience. I was kind of on board for the first two episodes. I think there's a lot more to come, and I think there's going to be some fairly hefty developments in terms of the future of mankind and the role that the aliens play upon their visitation. But for a slow burn startup to a series, I think they've done a pretty good job of it.
So, look, there's a challenge with the show in trying to really get your head around exactly what you're watching, because the show is being deliberately obtuse and not really giving you quite enough to latch onto. They do end the episode with a this season on three body problem, which is important because, one, it suggests that this is an unlimited series. This is going to be a truly ongoing concern. But then also it's enough to kind of give you as a viewer enough to latch into to say, you know what, this is something which I'm certainly interested enough in what I've seen here about what's to come, that I'm going to stick with this, because I don't know there's necessarily enough here in that first episode to say that I definitely need to press play on that second episode. But there's enough to say there's value in sticking around. What totally I did agree. Find as a bit of a, I guess a challenge as a viewer, is the opening sequence, which is a, you mentioned the Cultural Revolution taking place. What we're seeing here is a lot of young Chinese people, you know, the obvious allusion that's taking place is that it's kind of university-aged young people who are being critical of scientists to the point where they're beating one of them on stage to his death.
Yep.
I found myself watching this opening sequence, and it was fantastic. I was completely engaged in this. I was immediately drawn into the idea of talking about young people going up against previously held sort of systems and doctrines, which are by and large considered by most people to be accurate and true. And there's a really clear parallel to be drawn between what we were seeing in this opening sequence here to what we see in the real world at the moment, as you see a lot of young people challenging university systems as to what's, you know, correct language and behavior and thought to be taking place. And this is very much coming from that conversation from the viewpoint of, we know better than these young people. And when you're watching the show, the young people in this are clearly wrong. Okay, but it's very interesting to frame the opening of the series to be rooted so heavily in this conversation, which is so prevalent, I guess, in a lot of cultural discourse of the moment.
Totally agree. I think that's why the book has remained a constant bestseller and has become more and more relevant over time. And I guess that's why Netflix are gambling on such a big and expensive adaptation to work with the masses. So three body problem.
Simon, the challenge I had was that nothing that takes place after the first like 7 or 8 minutes of the show is anywhere near as compelling as that. And yet I'm still keen to see more of it.
Oh, for sure. Absolutely. All right. Three Body Problem is on Netflix. Definitely worth a look. Even for your non-sci-fi types out there, I think it's got a complex enough story to and good drama and good characters to drag you in. Let's go off to the movies again for the fifth go-round for the Ghostbusters.
I've been waiting 40 years for this. They called themselves Ghostbusters. According to these hacks, they saved the world. No eyewitnesses. And who is found to carry the torch? Descendants of Egon Spengler. You have a miner hanging out the side of a moving vehicle, firing a laser gun indiscriminately.
It has a proton pack.
It's completely safe.
I wouldn't say completely safe.
The Ghostbusters are finished.
Well, overruled.
Sustained.
Thank you.
Is it the fifth go-round or is it the fourth go-round, but just the fifth go-round for the IP? Question mark.
Yes, that is an important question and one we'll address later. Okay, Ghostbusters Frozen Empire sees our old friends join up with our new team of Ghostbusters that were introduced in Afterlife and fight off a, how would you describe the baddie in this? It's sort of a tall, horned, glowing monster type of beastie who is determined to spread the next ice age across the world. And it's up to our goofy Ghostbusting team to bring this crazy spirit to its knees. Let me just clonk onto the plot. And when I say clonk onto the plot, there's not a lot going on in this film. So the film goes back to New York City, which is good. I was entirely sort of on board from the opening of this film, where it shows the New York City of you know, the first film. And there's a lot of callbacks to the first film. That's just one of the one of many to start with. All of the descendants of Harold Ramis's Egon, who we met in Afterlife, have returned. Egon's daughter, Callie, played by Carrie Coon. She's sort of lightened up a bit, and she's living with her buddy, her boyfriend, Gary Gruberson, Paul Rudd, who he sort of is having trouble adapting to life as kind of a stepdad to the kids, those kids being Trevor, Finn Wolfhard from Stranger Things, he's 18 now, and Phoebe, the wonderful McKenna Grace, she's now 15. She gets pulled out of the Ghostbusters early on in a confrontation with the mayor of the city, who for some reason is the EPA guy from the first film. How that sort of came about is one of the many problems I have with this film. The first half of the film reintroduces us to Dan Aykroyd's character and Spengler and then Venkman, the Bill Murray character, who turns up for a little while. As the team starts to rise up and fight against the spirits that are being released into New York City, the film finds a bit of its old-style action comedy groove, but the first half is a real slog. It's like they're trying to introduce so many characters and hit so many beats, nostalgia beats along the way, that they don't really have anything to do other than be background. And when they do get to speak, you almost forget that people like James Acaster and Ernie Hudson were even in the film. I mean, even Carrie Coon, who was one of the central characters in the first film, at one point she's actually lying on her back, sort of texting on her phone as if she's got nothing to do, and I sort of that summed up her role in the film. The one thing that I did enjoy about this film, and a lot of the reviewers are kind of talking around it or not quite examining it, is the relationship between Phoebe, McKenna Grace, and a fellow teenage ghost played by Emily Aylin Lind. Now, this is clearly a connection made as a gay relationship. This is very clearly two young women who are connecting and exploring their affections for each other. And the beats that it hits and the plot as it unfolds is clearly the most interesting and I would say ambitious thing about the film. How Phoebe, having been cast out of the Ghostbusters and also feeling as an outsider with her own family, is suddenly finds this really quite intimate connection with Melody, Emily Aylin Lind's character, the ghost, and how that sort of starts to give us some kind of agency over her own life. And I thought the scenes between these two were really, really good, but almost from another movie entirely. Everything else in this did exactly what it had to do to play into my sort of nostalgia for the Ghostbusters. And I didn't not like this film, but it's actually a very minor effort, and I really don't think there's a whole lot of juice left in the Ghostbusters franchise. I'm not being ageist to say that the three original Ghostbusters look very old in this. Bill Murray especially is lacking some of the charm. The Venkman of this film is nowhere near the Venkman of the first or second Ghostbuster movies. So let's just say this is one very much for the adoring fans and for those willing to tolerate some old guys on screen having a bit of fun. All other characters in this, McKenna Grace aside, are pretty much wasted. So this one's watchable but forgettable.
Look, so I really didn't care for that last one, Afterlife, which was pretty much par for the course with Ghostbusters films. The first one's amazing, then everything after that is just you know, I'm not sure why we're bothering. But yeah, I really didn't care for Afterlife. You were a lot more supportive of that film than
I was. Yeah, in hindsight, maybe too much. It really only played to the nostalgic love, the rose-colored glasses fan like me, who was just seeing these guys back on screen after all the hooing and froing. I've gone back and watched it once, and it's fine, but it's no better or worse than this film.
Yeah, look, I mean, I think it's worse. I much preferred this film to that one. And part of it is because they set it back in New York City. I think that the some of the new supporting cast members, I think, actually are hugely engaging on screen. I really like seeing James Acaster, as wasted as he was. Joining this. I don't quite understand why you bring on a fairly funny comedian and then not actually give him any funny lines. That was a weird choice. But that's probably the thing with this movie, in that there's lots of just weird choices made. You talk about the queer relationship between the young girl, I can't think of her name right now, and the ghost, Melody. Yeah, and it just sort of seems as though they originally conceived it as being a queer character, then decided, got cold feet, that maybe this, you know, a queer character in, you know, Ghostbusters family-friendly IP like this wasn't necessarily something they should do, and then just backed away from it entirely. And either you go there or you don't. Like, it just sort of seemed as though they were straddling this point where it wasn't like an allusion to something. It just sort of seemed like they were just too afraid to, like, just embrace that as an actual story beat. And everything about that character reads as queer, just generally. Like, why not actually go there? But that was just kind of strange. And then there's just very sort of plot elements which are there either to harken back to the very first film. None of the other films are really referenced. Okay, let me just quickly go on a tangent. Why is it that the child from Ghostbusters 2, I think the kid's name is Oscar, being son of Dana Barrett and Peter Venkman, like, that kid is of, like, adult age now. If you're going to introduce, like, a new era of Ghostbusters characters into this, like, why is that kid not a character in this? But anyway, that's an aside.
Well, I would suggest you'd have to explain why Sigourney Weaver doesn't turn up in this at all. So that would be a problem.
Yeah, exactly. Also, why isn't Sigourney Weaver in this? Everyone else is.
I know, exactly. They drag back Annie Potts as Janine, and there's a scene where Annie Potts has to climb the stairs of the firehouse steps, and I thought, oh my God, she's not going to make it to the top. She was looking really... God bless her. Not being ageist, but let's be fair. You know, the first Ghostbusters was 40 years ago, and it kind of shows.
Yeah, look, it's been a while. So, look, you've got, like, that element, and they keep on bringing back elements. Like, I don't get why William Atherton's back as the EPA guy. It actually makes a lot of sense to me, have the mayor as the bureaucratic villain getting in the way of the Ghostbusters activity. Like, that makes perfect sense, but you didn't need to overstuff that by having it as William Atherton. Right. Like, I don't know how many, EPA bureaucrats end up making their way to become, like, the mayor or governors of cities and states, like... It's just a bizarre, move for it. There was no need for that. And then also all these, like, little throwaway moments, like Dan Aykroyd's character, Ray Stans, is going through the New York Library and then suddenly passes that same ghost that opens the Ghostbusters film, the 84 film. Like, why is she there? Like, didn't they catch her at some point? Like, total, that's baffling. At the end of the movie, what's the name? Slimer is, like, heavily present. And I'm like, why is Slimer hanging around the ghost house, the firehouse at this stage? It's just bizarre.
Yep.
Yeah. Like, it's just kind of like they're just letting you these bad choices made along the way, which is a shame because they make some really good choices through this as well. There's some jokes in this which genuinely land really, really well. There's additions to the cast, like Kamal Nanjiani's joins the cast.
He's a plus. Yeah. He's an absolute plus.
Yep. And if we're thinking about Ghostbusters, so bear in mind, when you watch the opening sequence to this film, you see the opening title cards come up, and you'll see a credit on there, which I'm pretty sure is there for Afterlife as well. They talk about it being a Ghost Core production. Yeah. Now, Ghost Core is the company that was set up to manage the Ghostbusters IP. So the idea was to launch Afterlife as a springboard to launch multiple Ghostbusters movies going forward. You know, it's the Marvelization of Hollywood. To do some TV series, animated shows, and have it as a big shared universe. And, like, that's all cool, and I like the idea that they are setting this up where there could be a Ghostbusters movie every couple of years, okay? And, like, that I actually find to be a fairly warm idea. I'm very much keen for that. But you need to set it up properly. And I've got all these elements in place, like James Acaster, like Camille coming through. Like, why can't you like give these guys an actual sort of real solid foundation so that these are the guys that are leading new Ghostbusters movies going forward? But instead, it's just looking too far into the past and doesn't really look forward. It's really, really frustrating. And the storyline you mentioned, how do you describe the villain? A non-event would be the way I'd describe that villain.
I thought it was the problem I had with that was the villain was kind of scary to look at, but doesn't really do anything. Just sort of head straight for the firehouse to take on the Ghostbusters for some reason. And there was also some great the little repossessor spirit in this that bounces from thing to thing was used for one kind of cool sequence, but not really well. And then there was that other thing with the big teeth that was behind the glass. And I thought, oh my God, I hope they unleash this. And it does nothing. It doesn't even become a part of the film. I thought there was a lot of missed opportunities here. I guess the casting of someone like Acaster, they might have been sort of shaping him up as this franchise's Rick Moranis Egon type goofy character or Egon character.
He's the Egon. Like, Conan and Johnny is supposed to be the Moranis. Yeah.
Yeah. So, look, this one stumbles out of the gate a bit. I thought the first hour was such a struggle. And I know there was a huge rush for the bathroom at one point in the film. I think about the point that Patton Oswalt starts to do the umpteenth version of what the story is going to be about at about the hour mark. And there were people in the bathroom saying, oh, it's so boring, it's so dull, which I wasn't totally on board with, but I certainly recognize that first hour is a bit light on laughs and a bit heavy on everything else. So who knows, where's this going to go? See it for McKenna Grey. She was great. Ghostbusters Frozen Empire is in cinemas everywhere this week.
Can I ask, sorry, before we sort of tap out, because there'll be people who are excited by the idea of seeing a Ghostbusters movie, and then there'll be a larger volume of people who are probably a bit more skeptical about it. If you're, you know, half interested, but, you know, you saw Afterlife and thought it was a little bit shit, like, do you think that you should bother with Frozen Empire? Frozen Empire?
Yeah.
That was called? Yeah. Should you bother with this, or should you maybe just wait till it turns up on a streaming service?
Oh, look, that says, does it need to be seen on the big screen? And to which I say, yes, everything does. I think this was quite a good-looking film. I think it wasn't a – I think Gil Keenan, the director, and Jason Reitman, who shared writing responsibilities of it, they provide some big-screen entertainment. But it may transfer better to the smaller screen with all that character stuff toing and froing for the first hour. That may play better in a more intimate setting. So, I mean – yeah, if you're a fan, you'll definitely have already probably bought your ticket. If not, I don't think this is your entry point for Ghostbusters.
Well, it's not necessarily a person's entry point, but like, should they bother? So you talked about it being a big screen versus a small screen. I'd say it's more a thing of investment of time and money to go and see this. Like, going to the movies isn't cheap. It's, you know, it sucks a few hours to see the movie and then also get there and back. Like, is that effort worth it for what's presented on screen?
Yes.
Yeah. Look, I'd be inclined to say that people should maybe check it out, but don't expect it to be one of your favorites of the year.
Exactly. All right, everybody, get your shirts off, start muscling up. It's time for Dan's review of Roadhouse. Oh, that hurt.
Before we start, do you have insurance?
What?
Your coverage good? Like, you have dental?
Oh, haha.
Is there a hospital nearby? Is it, like, too far?
About, like, 25 minutes, I'd say.
I just slapped you. Are you all right?
What?
So you like to fight. You ever win?
No one ever wins a fight.
Look, I think everybody's seen the original movie Roadhouse, and if you've seen the original movie Roadhouse, you kind of know what this movie is, so you're either in for it or not. What's different about this movie? Look, what's different about the movie is, one, I don't think the original Roadhouse is very good. Yeah, look, I know, people love the original Roadhouse. I've never understood it entirely.
I'm amazed it's emerged as some kind of pop culture artifact at all. I thought it was junk back then and it's junk now.
Yeah, if anything, it reads even more like junk now than it did back then. But look, for some reason, people get nostalgic about certain things, and this is one of these things that people seem to have a fondness for. So, I would say, why do you need to remake Roadhouse? And I would answer that with, why not? Like, you know, it's fine. What they've made here, I think, is actually a pretty fun, entertaining movie. The premise of this one, if you're Ghost House unfamiliar, Ghost House, sorry, I just read the word Ghostbusters on my screen and Roadhouse all at once. Isn't it a shame this wasn't called Ghost House?
Ghost House would have been.
But anyway.
Bill Murray. Bill Murray is a small town bouncer.
Look, okay. Okay, sorry. I hadn't really planned to go down this route, but, you know, we're here now. Okay, so in the original Roadhouse movie, Catherine Wilhoit plays a character in it. I think she's the waitress in the film, as I recall.
Yeah.
Catherine Wilhoit gave this interview to the AV Club a couple of years ago, and she said something which just is in my mind like once every 2 weeks. I think about this all the time. Apparently, ever since she started the movie Roadhouse, she gets random phone calls like once every like 6 months to, you know, a couple of years could pass by and then it'll just happen. And the time of the day could be like 9 o'clock in the morning. It could be 4 o'clock in the morning. It could be in the afternoon. There's no rhyme or reason to any of it. The only thing that triggers these phone calls is that Bill Murray's brothers, okay, because Bill Murray's brother Joel Murray, people see him regularly in movies and TV shows around the place. There's
Brian Doyle
Murray. There's another Murray brother who appeared in one movie and that never really quite took, and that was kind of the end of his career. And I feel like there's one more as well. I'm not sure, but there's a bunch of Murrays that people don't really think about that frequently. But often when the Murray brothers get together, they'll sit down and watch Roadhouse. And when they do, they always give her a phone call.
Wow.
Okay. And they don't really, they are more or less hoping to get her voicemail than anything else, but they will always give her a phone call. And so she tells a story about her husband answering the phone at like 3 a.m. to some very drunk Murray brothers just shouting down the line.
Oh, very it's a funny. Movie to, it's a movie to be watched drunk. That's for sure. From what I remember of it.
Look, absolutely. They're doing it right. But anyway, Roadhouse, the whole premise of this one is Jake Gyllenhaal is a former MMA fighter who was involved in some sort of an incident back in the day. That incident has more or less been purged from YouTube, but videos crop up every so often of what was seemingly a very ghastly experience. Since then, subsequently, he now gets involved in underground fight clubs around the place, which is where we see him at the very beginning in a very, very violent fight, which was very welcome. Gosh, I enjoyed that. You see that he's approached by a woman that runs a Roadhouse bar, which is also called Roadhouse. And she's like, hey, I need someone to work as a bouncer for a couple of weeks. We've got some fairly unruly patrons that have been causing some problems lately. Could you pop by? He's like, no, I'm not going to do that. And then 5 minutes later, because movies, he's on his way to Florida, to the Roadhouse, to work as a bouncer. Along the way, he meets a bunch of people who are immediately enamored with him because he's a very charming guy. And Jake that's Gyllenhaal. Really, I think, he's Jake Gyllenhaal. And like that to me is the secret of this film, in that Jake Gyllenhaal, when it was announced that he was starring in Roadhouse, everyone was a little bit baffled by that. And the Gyllenhaal that we see in this version of the film is jacked. Like, this guy has certainly put the work in to be starring in this Roadhouse film.
Yeah,
it's very impressive. Okay, but he's like a weird, quirky guy. And that's his character in this. It's a bit of a weird, quirky guy. He's not the sort of guy you'd expect to be an MMA fighter, but he's definitely a guy who has found, I guess, maybe some inner peace in his world, but still has this monster that wants to get out. And throughout this movie, we see that monster get out, and boy, he creates some carnage and violence along the way.
And I would also suggest that the monster does take a human form in this, in the shape of Conor McGregor, who is a hired hand for the main baddie in this one, who was played by Ben Gazzara in the original film, and I don't know who plays it in this one, someone on a telephone. But Conor McGregor turns up and just chews the scenery. The way he walks and entered that entrance is one of the great entrances in cinema history, to put it. And when you see it, you'll know exactly what I mean by entrance. It's he is a nutsy, cuckoo, crazy, bloodthirsty individual who shows no mercy for mankind or furniture or mirrors or
pants.
Or pants. Yeah, so if you're going to watch this and the one fresh and exciting thing that does come out of this is watching Conor McGregor give one of the great cuckoo performances of all time.
Yeah, this kind of has the opposite problems what you were complaining about with Ghostbusters, in that I actually think the first sort of first half to two thirds of this are highly entertaining. And then I wouldn't say that the film goes to be by the numbers, but as soon as the film starts stepping away really far away from the titular Roadhouse, like, it kind of loses something about it. It stops being
just total B movie VHS action,
yeah,
which is kind of what the first one was. And this one recaptures that suitably enough. But I mean, this is the sort of movie that you end up watching slouch back on your couch with corn chip crumbs on your belly, and you know, there's, because you just see it and because of the name, you'll have a look at it. It's the first one was junk and this one is junk too.
Look, I am going to be more charitable. I think this one is, I mean, I don't know, the first one is knowingly junk. Like, this film is certainly knowingly junk, but it's hugely entertaining junk. I really enjoyed it, except for like maybe the final acts. I think it just lost a lot of the energy it had, which is unfair because I kind of think that everyone's bringing their all to that final act. It just doesn't quite work on screen for whatever reason.
Can you believe that Doug Liman did his line in the sand about this movie's theatrical release? Because I think it works absolutely fine as a small screen film. And if I'd have seen that some of these CGI fights on the big screen where they would have looked doubly crappy, I can't believe this is his line in the sand moment with regard to keeping his films in theatres.
Wait, did you not see this on a small screen?
Yeah. No, I did. I did, but if I'd seen it on the big screen, the CGI would have been very pronounced. Yeah, it would have been very pronounced, and I would have gone, ugh, no way, this is stupid stinky.
I actually think that's pretty common with special effects. Like, I tend to find that I don't notice them at all on the big screen. As soon as I watch them at home, like, it's like a visual equivalent of being tin-eared. Like, it just looks crappy and unengaging, and I never really... Like, I can very rarely see, like, a Marvel film, for example, on a small screen because the limited spectacle that you see on this thing just doesn't really exist on a small screen.
Okay.
I'm willing to look the other way on some of the CG fight sequences. Like, they're appropriately bloody enough and unexpected to, kind of be fun and a bit ridiculous. Mm. But to me, this is a film that works absolutely on a small screen, but probably works best if you don't do it like I did, which just sitting by myself with chips running down my shirt. Okay, but instead have a couple of friends around. There's some drinks, maybe some gummies, whatever, tickles your fancy.
Gummies?
I reckon an environment like that. Simon, it's 2024. This is how people do it.
Yeah, I didn't know how it was you did it.
I'm saying this is how people do it, Simon. But yeah, like, I kind of feel as though that's the environment. This is a group hang watch. I don't think this is a cinema watch. I don't think this is a watch it by yourself. You can certainly see it in a cinema. You can certainly see it by yourself, but you're going to have the most fun if it's a Friday night and you've got a rambunctious group of people who are giving it the appropriate level of shit that it deserves, but also cheering and just going completely crazy for it. So if you can do that, 5 stars.
Right. Roadhouse is on Amazon Prime, the new Jake Gyllenhaal. Now, I say Jake Gyllenhaal, you say Gyllenhaal. And I want to raise this because last week we reviewed, I'll do this very quickly, we reviewed Girls on the Bus, and you said Melissa Benoist, and I say Melissa Benoist. So we have a few sort of grey areas in our pronunciations.
Look, I don't think I've heard... Benoist's name sort of read out loud, but I do know that when you're dealing in polite company, women don't like hearing the word Benoist.
It's time for intermission.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. It's intermission time.
I came up with this one this week based on Immaculate being in cinemas. I've called this one, oh my God, the best and worst of religious horror. So, yes, Immaculate is in theaters. There's a new riff on The Omen coming in a couple of weeks. So one thing is certain and has been for centuries, religion remains a great source of things to frighten us. Being podcasting's most pious pair, we decided to look back at 5 good and bad movies about nasty nuns or vicious vicars or monstrous monks that have made our body and our blood chill. Gee, I write those well sometimes. Sometimes. Dan Barrett, I'm going to sort of kick this one off, and I'm going to avoid the sort of the high fruit on this one, or the low fruit, I guess you could say, things like The Exorcist or The Omen, or what are some of the others that I had on my list? They're things that we talk about, Rosemary's Baby, The Omen, Midsummer comes up a lot, The Wicker Man. They're all obviously classic religious horror films, but I'm going to look at 5 very quickly that will appeal to those who like getting their socks scared off, but while also feeling a little bit at one with the universe as well, at one with our good Lord. The first one I'm going to play with is Saint Maur. This is a film that stars Morford Clark as a religious private carer who becomes absolutely fixated on saving the soul of her patient, drives her to the point of madness. This is the new film from the, or the original film from the director of Love Lies Bleeding, a young filmmaker called Rose Glass, and she makes a terrifically entertaining film filled with all those really terrifying elements of religious sort of conviction that that can run people right off the rails. You with me on this, Dan Barrett?
Oh, I haven't seen it.
Okay. You got one to go.
Sorry. I'm supposed to offer. Sorry, I thought you were just going to do like five movies and I'll do five TV shows.
Oh, I can do that. I can just rattle on. Absolutely. We can do that all.
Let's nail them out.
All right, okay. My next one to have a look at is a film from the late 80s called The Seventh Sign. It's Demi Moore. She becomes pregnant. There's a lot of sort of parallels with Immaculate in this one. She becomes pregnant to Michael Biehn's baby. Jürgen Prochnow is on the scene. He may or may not be the reincarnation, or the baby may or may not be the reincarnation of Christ. And before you know it, there's thrills aplenty as priests and assassins and all sort of people come out of the woodwork to try to bump her off. It's a film that was savaged by the critics back in the day, but it's one that the final moments of it absolutely make me cry, but it's also a terrific thriller. The Sacrament is Ty West's film about a cult, about a film crew that goes into a Jim Jones kind of cult set up, all done in the found footage style. Joe Swanberg is the lead actor in this, and he's never done better work. He does terrifying really good. Jacob's Ladder with Tim Robbins. Jacob Ladder, for those of us who know our Bible, is the staircase that leads up to the pearly gates, which gives us some hint as to what Tim Robbins is going through in this film. Flashback sequences to Vietnam and flash forward sequences with his wife, Elizabeth Pena, start to become very focused and very dark. And this is another one that really taps into the spiritual nature of horror and religious horror. The best religious horror film ever made is Martyrs, a French film, about a secret organization that puts young women through hideous torture to the point of them seeing God. If you haven't seen Martyrs, the last 10 minutes of this film will absolutely blow you away. Be warned, it is very much central to that French extreme horror wave that sort of happened in the early 2000s. And this is a movie that I saw at the Melbourne Film Festival in 2012, I think, or 2013. And it was one of the most terrifying, but also one of the most emotional films I've ever seen. Martyrs, a really flash Blu-ray DVD has been released by Umbrella over the last year or so. And if you can get hold of that, it's a great way to watch it. But be warned, it's brutal. So they're my favorite religious horror films.
Yeah, so horror just broadly as a concept is a little bit hard to really capture on TV in the same way. So TV, because traditional TV, at least when you're dealing with ad breaks a lot more, it's hard to really get those rhythms in place to actually genuinely scare people. It's also TV, because it's been so heavily regulated by broadcast networks, particularly from the US, where they're scared of anything. Often you can't really go, you know, really sort of too far out there, because you're just not going to get it past the censors. So just traditionally, TV's never been a great place for it. In a post-streaming environment, things have changed a little bit more. You're not necessarily having to interrupt your flow by having ad breaks through there. It helps you actually build tension and whatnot. So there have been a number of scary TV programs of late. But just broadly, you don't quite have those same sort of all-timers working on that same way of, this is the scariest TV show you're ever going to get to see. Instead, what you probably have with TV is that when they try to do horror, religious or otherwise, it starts to be maybe a little bit more textual, where it's not really about jump scares, but really sort of an examination of evil or of like the ideas of horror. And sometimes when they just try to go there with horror, like they can try, it just never really works. So I've got a couple of things in mind. Millennium is one that jumped in mind. This is a broadcast network show, spin-off from The X-Files back in the 90s. The second season of this one, so the first season of it was very much about, it was a Silence of the Lambs-inspired serial killer of the week with Lance Henriksen in the lead role as Frank Black, and every week he was, you know, checking out serial killers. There was a very sort of small ongoing storyline about the company that he worked for. It was a consultancy company that was hired by the police to, you know, check out the nasties of the nasty. But this company seems to have some sort of a religious belief system taking place, even though that wasn't strictly the perspective he was coming from with it. But in the second season, after it didn't rate very well, they decided to upend the entire premise of the series, and it went really, really heavily into this shadowy organization that ran the consultancy. So for an entire season, there was lots of conversations about the way that these police officers are positioned, either as pursuers of a religious truth, or people who were completely agnostic, or in the parlance of the show, the roosters versus the owls. I think the owls were the religious types, as I recall. Sorry, it's been about 20 years. Fantastic. Yeah, great show. I had some real sort of moments of oddity and weirdness. The sort of stuff you can only get away with when nobody is watching your show, including, I think, the network. Really great show. Not available for streaming anywhere. It just hasn't been made available, which is weird because, like, The X-Files is kind of everywhere, and you'd think there's a crossover audience there, but it's just not there. Similarly, the show Profiler, which quietly Chris Carter may have ripped off in terms of the premise for the original incarnation of Millennium, that's not available anywhere either, which I find kind of strange. Moving on, there was and this is the only reason I got this on my list is because this show shouldn't work at all, but it actually kind of did. Taking into account what I said about broadcast networks and whatnot, a TV series adaptation of the movie The Exorcist should not work as a TV series. Surprisingly, really effective. Simon, did you ever watch this?
Yeah, I watched a few episodes. I never got all the way through it, but I'm a big Gina fan, so yes, I was keen to see what they did. And yeah, those first few episodes hooked me in, but life took over and I never got back to it. But I've always wanted to.
Yeah, Gina Davis and Alan Rock were the two sort of adult leads in it. But yeah, surprisingly very good. One which was made completely for streaming, and Simon, you and I both had this as one of our favorite shows of the year that it came out, which was, you know, a couple ago now, Midnight Mass, which was Mike Flanagan's Netflix series. This was a show which very much had a fairly slow build. This is a show with a guy coming to an island. There's, you know, creepy people around, and then it starts edging its way towards, I think, episode 7 of 8. Which is set in a church, as suddenly the revelation as to what was really taking place in the show got revealed. And when that happened, boy, for the next like 30, 40 minutes, I could not have been more captivated on screen by some of the bloodshed and carnage and just weird shit that I was seeing on screen. Like, really just incredible TV. If you haven't seen Midnight Mass, like, you got to check out the show. It's like not enough people talked about it, which is just bizarre to me because that episode, my God.
It wasn't as easy it came after House on Haunted Hill, which had a real sort of clarity to it, and you could, and it was sort of cut from a classic sort of haunted house cloth. Midnight Mass was you had to be a lot more invested and had a lot more of a ambitious storytelling bent to it. And it's one of those shows that someone like Flanagan gets to make after he has the sort of hit that he had with House on Haunted Hill. So, it wasn't the talking point like Haunted Hill was, but I think it's probably his Flanagan's masterpiece.
Yeah, it's a bit Wicker Man like, if people want to.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah,
yeah. If it's a conversation with me, it's always going to start heading in this direction. I'm going to introduce two names into this conversation now, which I often do. Robert and Michelle King, creators of The Good Wife and The Good Fight and whatnot. They had a particularly odd little TV show just after The Good Wife finished up. It was called Brain Dead. And this was this isn't even religious. Sorry, I just got excited. Sorry, I added my fifth title on here and then I worked backwards. Anyway, Brain Dead, check it out. It's pretty good. Anyway, something which is actually religiously tinged is Evil, which is their current series, one of the two current shows they've got on the air. This is one which is it's kind of them doing like a modern version of Millennium or The X-Files. It's three people that have been brought together to try to tackle cases that have been brought to the church where the church isn't really sure whether or not there is a religious impact taking place and they should actually be paying attention to it for a possible exorcism, or whether or not they're being, you know, led on, or if it's something else entirely. So there's a priest, there's a woman who's a psychologist by background, so she's the non-believer. Obviously the priest is the believer, and then you've got a third guy who doesn't really care either way. He's really just there for a paycheck, but also kind of understands fakes and frauds and likes playing around in sort of technology spaces.
Regular listeners will know, you know, regular listeners will absolutely know how much you love Evil. And you introduced me to it. It was a show that I hadn't heard of, which I think was one of the big problems with this. It was very tough getting the word out about it. But I remember that first season being terrifically entertaining. And yes, she's lovely.
Yeah. Oh, look, she's very lovely. But look, the first season's pretty good, but this is a show that builds season on season. And every season has at least two or three episodes, which are genuinely just bizarrely creepy. The creepiest of them doesn't really have... Well, sorry, there's two episodes that I think it is quickly worth mentioning. There's one which, in the spirit of talking about Immaculate, which we've been talking about, there's an episode where something's taken place, which leads the three to a convent where everyone's taken a vow of silence. Pretty creepy, but really plays into that religious side of the show pretty heavily. The show gets more and more sort of religiously interested as it goes in, but don't be put off by that. It really is sort of for the benefit and creepiness of the show. But the creepiest episode isn't really religious focused, but it is a religious-based show. It's got the character of Ben, who's the not a believer, but also doesn't really care one way or another guy. He has heard about like this urban legend about a floor that exists between other floors in a hotel building. Anyway, he goes into this elevator, puts in a special code that apparently gets you to this level, gets out, steps out, the door closes behind him, it's locked, and then suddenly he loses his phone. So it's this dark area with all sorts of weird, creepy aspects to it, and he's locked. Nobody knows that he's there, and it's literally, what do you do when you are locked in a place and nobody knows that you're missing, let alone that you need help to be found? Anyway,
creepy stuff. All right.
Super creepy.
Yes. But has that been picked up? Because I know they cancelled it. Was it going to go to another network?
Look, so this is, you know, just one of these things. Debuted on broadcast TV, did pretty well, but it never really quite fit right on the CBS schedule for reasons that the show is a bit more adult than it probably should be on a broadcast network like that.
Yeah.
But they have Paramount Plus. They're like, let's do this as a Paramount Plus show. So it becomes a Paramount Plus original where it completely disappears off the face of the earth. They've done a couple of seasons there. The upcoming fifth season is going to be the last one. It's a slightly truncated... Oh, sorry, no, it's a regular season, okay? But while this... Maybe it's the fourth season. I'm not sure. We're in four or five. I can't remember now. I'm going to say four. But they've announced that there will be like a short run.
It can be found,
I think, maybe
on Paramount Plus. Okay.
Yeah, but there's like going to be another like very short season that's going to come after the one that's about to debut in May. And that'll wrap it up within just a couple of episodes. So
Sweet. The
creators of the show seem happy with it. Therefore, I'm happy with it. But look, I'm just happy to see more of this because this is a show that never should be. Like, it is just genuinely fun and creepy, surprisingly very funny at times. It's stimulating in all the ways, and more people should be checking this one out.
That was the best and worst of religious horror films. I'm going to list those on our Facebook page and our Threads channel, so you can go out and check those and know what one we've talked about. Dan Barrett, one each in the What Else Have You Been Watching section.
Okay, Simon, what were you doing in, let's say, 1992?
1992. Probably having divorce papers sent to me by somebody. I was a sales rep in the home video industry, so I was drinking every night. That was pretty much my 1992 from what I can remember of it. Seems like a long time ago. What were you doing?
Well, I was a 12-year-old massive nerd sitting on my couch watching cartoons, and one of these cartoons was a little show called X-Men, the Animated Series. So this is a show which launched about a year or so after there was huge success with the Batman Animated Series, the Batman animated series hit TV with some heavy sort of cinematic inspiration, a animation style copied from the Fleischer Superman cartoons from the 40s. This was a big budget, stylish, really smart TV program. The X-Men show launched in its wake, had far lower budget animation, was very much not necessarily the critical darling that the Batman show was. But if you were roughly about my age, this was one of the better cartoons on. And we all watched X-Men, the animated series. It took its inspiration very much from the comic books and tried to bring the soap opera elements of the comics into a TV Saturday morning cartoon style. The show ran for about 4 or 5 years, got cancelled. By the time it got cancelled, anyone who'd been watching the show at the beginning had well and truly stopped watching it at that point. It just disappeared into the ether, never to be thought of again. But we live in this era of peak TV, Simon. And oh, so what is more peaky than reviving the X-Men animated series for what would be, I guess, the fifth season of the show? So it's now back as this thing on Disney Plus called X-Men 97.
And with arrested development. Yeah, go on.
Well, the show finished in 1996, so this is the theoretical 1997 season of the program. Okay. Yeah. And so it's on. And look, as I said, like, I'd stopped watching the original series. I've been curious about going back to watch it and to see if the show was actually any good. And from what I could see from the 2 to 3 episodes before I just had stopped watching it, no, it was never very good. Okay. But
might I suggest that you've maybe matured to some extent? No, that's
what I like. My, no, like, very, I felt like very I had to small.
Say something, but that wasn't it.
No, but like, this is the thing. So I've created this cartoon show, continuing the story from the original version. But what they've done is, it is 2024, so it's now debuting with much better animation than the original one ever did, and just a little bit sort of smarter storytelling. So it's keeping what worked about that series originally, what resonated with kids like myself on the couch, and it's tried to present it in a more modern context. So within the
X-Men, is it all the big name X-Men? Is it all the ones I know from the movies, or is it going to be all those weird little ones that I'd never heard of that kind of got me bored with the X-Men in the end?
No, well, it's the exact same characters that were in the 1991 X-Men. So these are your classic X-Men characters. So these are your characters like a gentleman named Wolverine. You've probably heard of him.
I know of him, yes.
Cyclops, aka Scott Summers. He's one of the main characters.
Yeah,
James Marsden. Jean Grey, I believe you've heard of her.
Femke Janssen, I'm doing this from the movie, yeah.
Yeah. The main sort of dramatic sort of crux of the original show, which is certainly something from the comics, is that Wolverine loves Jean Grey, Jean Grey loves Scott Summers and also kind of loves Wolverine as well, and therefore Scott and Wolverine hate each other. And so that's the dynamic, and if Scott Summers wasn't in the picture, Wolverine would absolutely be in the picture. And so that's established. As the new season takes off, Jean Grey's now pregnant, which just throws an extra sort of, you know, emotional spanner into the works.
Sure.
There's a few characters you may not know. So Jubilee, who I think was a character introduced maybe in X-Men 3, possibly. Not too sure.
Who that is.
But anyway, she's a character in it. Beast, who you know from, like, you know, the X-Men movies.
That was Frasier.
Yeah, it was Frasier. So he's in there. There's a character called Gambit, who you won't know. I think was going to be played in a Gambit live-action movie by Magic Mike himself.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Who else have we got in there? In the new season, I think that's all you... Oh, sorry, and Storm, who you know from the live-action films as well. Storm. Who could forget Storm?
I love Storm.
But I guess the twist with the new one... I love
Rebecca Romijn. Remember Rebecca Romijn in the first one when and she her role was taken over by Mystique. Jennifer Lawrence? Yeah, but
look, Mystique was absolutely a character from the original animated show. I've only seen the first episode of the revival, so I don't know if we see Mystique again, but we very well may. Okay.
Okay.
But what the twist is you got two new characters in this one. There's Bishop, who was a character in the original animated show from the comics, and also Morph, a character that was from the original series, from the animated show, was never from the comics, and was there purely just be murdered in the first two episodes of the show. At least I think he was murdered. I don't remember. It's been years and who cares?
Nasty.
Okay. But here's where our heads in being interesting, Simon. He's a queer character. And so by using the character of Morph, they've brought X-Men 97 into 2024, and they're actually exploring some of the elements of the X-Men, which have always been there thematically, but haven't necessarily been brought to the screen. So when you're watching the X-Men movies, maybe you're not really noticing so much that the entire premise of the X-Men is a metaphor for not just outsiders, but particularly queer people. And so this animated show, by reintroducing Morph in as a core character and as a queer character, the show is actually sort of positioning the X-Men to be a little bit more overt in what the thematic underpinnings of the entire IP is.
Interesting. Can't wait to see the internet react to that. Okay, X-Men 97 is where? How do we watch it?
On Disney Plus.
Disney Plus. I just want to very quickly mention what else I've been watching. One of the biggest movies in the world at the moment is Ex Humor. It is a South Korean horror film in which four kind of Ghostbuster-y types come to think of it, but one's a parapsychologist, one's a gravedigger, one's a psychologist. They all sort of come together to try to help a family get over a curse, which then focuses on them. This has taken upwards of $100 million at the South Korean and Japanese box office. It's a long haul at 2 hours and 15 minutes, but it's got some of the creepiest moments that I've seen in a movie theater in some time. So if you can't get into Immaculate this week, let's face it, you'll have no trouble getting into Immaculate. But if you want a good scare, Ex Humor is the South Korean blockbuster at the moment, which is in Australian cinemas nationwide.
Now, Daniel sorry, Barrett. Simon, before you continue on. Wait a sec, before you continue on, Simon's trying to censor me. He is too afraid of me talking about Chicken Nugget, a brand new series on Netflix. The series is a South Korean show. Simon, the series is about a South Korean, it's a South Korean show about a guy who's in love with the boss's daughter. On the day that she comes to visit the office, a mysterious machine arrives. She goes inside the machine, gets turned into a chicken nugget.
I'm
telling you, Simon, show of the year.
Oh, really? Well, we should do a big thing on that, because that is something I've watched. South Korean entertainment is some of the most interesting stuff around. Ex Humor is great. Chicken Nugget sounds about as original as you can get.
Look, it's original, but yeah. I'm maybe being a little bit tongue-in-cheek when I say show of the year, but it is very interesting. And while I had no interest in watching it, I was trying to find out more about the lead actor in it, and I accidentally read the synopsis of episode 9. And now I think I need to watch the whole thing. It is. It goes to some pretty weird places, I suspect.
Does it have the actress's face like on a chicken nugget? And it's like, she talks like that. I can't figure it out. I've got to watch this show.
So she's not a walking, talking chicken nugget. She's just a chicken nugget. But here's what's important to know about the chicken nugget. Okay. The chicken nugget, it's not the sort of chicken nugget you go down and get at Macca's for, you know, like $3 for 25 nuggets. Okay. It's not one of those nuggets. It's a South Korean nugget, which means it's this big, chunky, deep fried looking thing. And you will not be hungrier for nuggets than watching this program.
I am hungry for nuggets right now. I'm a nugget kind of guy. All right. That's on Netflix, if I believe.
Correct.
Dan Barrett, This Week in History. We're going to rattle through. Okay, you ready? March 25, 2019 saw the launch of which new streaming platform?
Did I not just mention Disney Plus a few moments ago?
Oh, well, you may have, but you'd be wrong.
Oh, well, that wasn't my answer, obviously.
Nice backpedal. Yeah, what else? What's your answer then?
What, 2019? I don't know.
It's, Apple what Plus? Is that? What that, are was, we... that was when Apple Plus launched.
Apple TV Plus.
March 26, 1958.
Simon, wait. Simon, Apple TV Plus, best show on it. Go.
Platonic.
I mean, I liked it. It's not the best show on there.
No, I'm trying to think of what other one I loved. Well, I loved the first season of Physical, but I'm a Rose Byrne nut, obviously.
Yeah, clearly.
Invasion was good. I haven't gone back for the second season of Invasion. I really like that. What was yours? Go.
Stillwater.
Yeah, nobody watched that. That was the panda one, wasn't it?
It is. You only know about it because I've talked about it.
I've never heard of it otherwise.
Seriously, you've got an Apple TV Plus subscription?
Yeah.
Yeah. Watch the first episode of Stillwater. It's a kid's cartoon, but watch it and you will be very impressed by it.
Wow. Okay, let's do that. March 26, 1958, which classic war film premieres in theaters on its way to 7 Oscars? March 26, 1958.
I don't know. What is it?
Bridge on the River Kwai.
Of course.
And March 26, 1995, infamous for providing a brief glimpse of its leading man's junk, which movie took out the worst film Razzie Award on this day, March 26, 1995?
1995, not a clue. Razzie Awards, not sure. Leading man's junk, I believe we're talking about one Bruce Willis in a film called Color of Night.
You are exactly right. You know your leading man's junk, Dan Barrett. I knew you'd get that one straight away. Let's go to the birthday quiz.
No, not happy birthday.
All right. A little bit of a clue for you on this one. This one is a movie title connection. I don't think you'll get this, but let's give it a go. March 24, 1990, the beautiful Keisha Castle Hughes, who we many remember was one of the youngest Oscar nominees for the beautiful film Wild Rider. March 24, 1977, Jessica Chastain. March 24, 1960, won Kelly LeBrock. March 27, 2000, the beautiful Halle Bailey from The Little Mermaid and one other film. That is kind of a clue to what the answer might be. It's a movie title connection. Dan Barrett, you got anything?
Okay, so my answer just has to be what the connection is.
Yeah.
Well, I don't need to list the movies.
Well, I'd rather if you did, but give it a shot.
Okay, well, the connection is the color red is in movie titles that I've been in. So Keisha Castle Hughes, who I met once and was really quite nice, she was in Red Dog, the Australian film about the dog who's a bit red. Then you've got Kelly LeBrock, who's been in, I believe, a grand total of 2 movies. And one of those was The Woman in Red.
Yep.
Jessica Chastain... Gosh, like, obviously it's a red in the title. I feel she might have been in a film called The Red Queen, but I don't know if that's true or not.
No.
And Halle Bailey, something else red. What have we got?
Okay, so you're absolutely on the right path. I don't know how to do this. You're probably using some sort of AI algorithm to figure this out. Yes, Keisha Castle Hughes from Red Dog. Yes, Kelly LeBrock from Woman in Red. Jessica Chastain was in Crimson Peak. And Halle Bailey was in The Color Purple. The actual answer was they've all been with movies with color in the color in the title, but, you know, purple's kind of red. So we'll give it to you on that one. Well done, Dan Barrett. I don't know how you do that so well. How do you do that? Are you doing some sort of Google word search or something?
LeBrock is either Weird Science or Woman in Red. Like, it's one or the other. And I couldn't connect any of them. And then I remembered Castle Hughes was in Red Dog.
And I'm glad you brought it up. It's a beautiful segue. I'm showing Weird Science at the Blacktown Drive-In as part of my 6 months of retro sci-fi screenings there. We kick it off April 27 with Mad Max, and we roll that into the last Saturday in May for Weird Science. So get along. I'll put something up on our Facebook page about it. Oh, we're at the end of the show.
We are. Simon, it's been a pleasure.
It has been a joy. Screen watching. Follow us on Facebook at Screen Watching Podcast. We've got some ticket giveaways over there for the new Ava DuVernay film, Origin, and for a wonderful Sudanese drama called Goodbye Julia. Get in quick while we've still got some tickets for them. On Threads and at YouTube at Screen Watching. And you can email us screenwatchingpodcast@gmail.com with any questions or ideas or suggestions about our little podcast that we do.
Now, I got onto the Facebook the other day. I was taking a look at what's been posted on Screen Watching.
Yeah, okay. No, you took offense.
Yeah, and I was just going to say maybe to everyone, just know that Simon looks after that.
I think they could tell by your comments that I'm the one that does it. What did you get rolled up about? I can't remember. You got angry about the Patricia Heaton thing, which
you were posting some nonsense.
The thing about
The Patricia Heaton thing.
The thing about from Time Magazine you got rolled up about as well. I remember that.
I don't know. You just keep on publishing trash. I don't know.
But anyway, Facebook. That's what you do. Folks,
if you want to if you want to get along to a much more dignified digital space, check out alwaysbewatching.com. It's a newsletter I publish on almost every day, except for today, where I am many hours late and being held up by this podcast. But you can find there, it's a daily wrap of all the important news stories and whatnot about mostly streaming TV, but a little bit about movies in there, and anything that you can watch on a screen generally gets covered on that. A whole bunch of trailers as well for upcoming programs. Speaking of trailers, Simon, I'm kind of into the look of the new Star Wars TV show. I think The Acolyte looks pretty fun.
It does look terrific. That was a good trailer. It's been quite a big week for trailers. Just in the hours before we did this podcast, the trailer for Beetlejuice dropped, a minute and a half teaser trailer. I've already put that up on our Facebook page. And we had a new Alien Romulus trailer drop this week as well. So it's a lot of the big sort of summer properties are starting to give us a first glimpse. And, it is pretty exciting. Yeah, The Acolyte.
Also, Game of Thrones, House of the Dragon Season 2 released not one but two trailers because the series is about dueling families, and so there's a trailer from each family's perspective, which I thought was
fun.
That's
a great idea. Well done, HBO or Max or whoever's doing it. That's just good marketing. Thanks, Dan. It's been fun.
Thank you, Simon. We'll be back next week with more of this fun. We'll see you then.